Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken is just back from New Hampshire. It took him longer to get back here than just about anybody
else.
And
boy, are my delegates tired.
I tell you, it took Ken just about forever to get back. But then, of course, there was all that, 55-degree temperatures and so on. The weather was a real challenge.
And I think that's the reason why Obama lost.
So, Ken, I just have to ask you, how do you do it? How do you stay so fresh? How do you stay so wonderful day after day?
I don't know. This
is very personal for me.
You know, the podcast helps, of course. And
it's not just political. It's not just public.
But if you didn't believe deeply in the podcast, could you really go on? Could you do it?
Well, you know, the column, the political junkie column.
That means something.
Helps, you know, helps.
But it's mostly the podcast.
Okay, I'm tired of doing Ed Muskie impersonations. Wow.
Here's a question. Yeah. Why did it do Ed Muskie in and make Hillary Clinton's day?
Because
can we tell the listener we're talking about crying in public in New Hampshire when questioned?
Now, of course, we're going to get a lot of letter from our listener saying that.
What
Hillary
that
Clinton did not
five
cry.
Minutes. Oh, she didn't cry. She just welled up a little.
She did,
bit.
But you know something? It was an emotional moment.
It was an emotional
because
moment.
Because she listens to the podcast, and we've been saying that she's the inevitable nominee.
And we've been saying that she was kind of a little on the chilly side as a personality.
Well,
not necessarily all that likable.
As chilly as Warren Harding is today, yes.
And we've been saying that perhaps she needed to be a little less mechanical.
Wait. Are you saying, because I don't agree with this, I don't think you're saying this either, but, Ron Elving, you're not saying that this was a calculated move on Hillary Clinton's part, no.
Not initially. Not when the tear first began to appear. That, I think, was probably spontaneous, probably a function to some degree of exhaustion. We could hear it a little bit that same morning in her live interview with Morning Edition here on NPR, when she sounded a little stressed out, a little strained, a bit perhaps worn out by not only the campaign, but the beating, the thumping that she'd been taking in the media for days, for weeks, about the decline in her fortunes, and particularly after her surprise loss in Iowa.
Now, I don't know what it was like nationally, but in New Hampshire talk radio, everybody was talking about the cry or the breakdown or the emotional moment, and women were calling in saying, that was the pivotal moment for me. That's the moment where I decided that Hillary Clinton would be my choice.
Okay, what we have here is the birth, perhaps, of a political urban legend. We have this tale of the tear, which is dominating the coverage, dominating the explanation for how she turned around what appeared to be an 8-to-10-point deficit in
her own polls.
In her own polls, as well as those of literally everyone else, with possibly the exception of Suffolk University. I don't know what's the matter with Suffolk University. But she goes from that deficit to a 3-point win, 2.5 thereabouts. Nobody has a perfect explanation for this, but we have this highly symbolic moment, this telling moment, which we've all fixed in our minds, of this tear welling up in her eye and women suddenly coming home. She wins by 12 points among women, whereas she lost by a couple of points among women in Iowa. And people are seizing on this tale of the tear as the explanation. But it can't entirely be the explanation because, among other things, the exit polls show clearly not that many people more voted for Hillary than voted for Obama among those who decided at the last minute.
That's what's strange, too. And also, if 57% of the New Hampshire electorate who turned out on Tuesday were women...
Among Democrats.
So were women, then, you know, and then the fact that she won by less than... So, I mean, obviously it was
barely.
Not a monolithic
That's
vote,
right.
Women's vote.
That's right. Younger women tended still to vote more for Obama, although they voted more for Clinton than they had in Iowa. There did seem to be something happening across all age groups and to some lesser degree across all income and education groups, as long as you're talking about women. That's the one common factor in the change between Iowa and New Hampshire. So clearly something was going on. I don't know that it was caused by the tear, but I think it was symbolized. In this particular instance, we saw a group of people who have always been subtext to the entire process of 2007, 2008, suddenly asserting themselves in a completely different and, if you will, cohesive way to object to something they saw going on in this process, in the Democratic nomination process, which was the apparent early rejection of Hillary for reasons that a number of women suddenly resented.
Here's my problem with that, because I also heard a lot of people say that they didn't like the way Obama and Edwards ganged up on Hillary Clinton
on Saturday night.
On Saturday night at the debate. But ostensibly, they've been ganging up on Hillary Clinton. You can make the argument not because she's a woman, but because she's the front runner. But they've been ganging up on her for quite some time, and yet she still lost Iowa, finished third in Iowa. So I don't know why women suddenly became very protective.
Well, it was crystallized, partly by the debate, partly by the sort of pat on the arm, patronizing remark that Obama made when he said, in the midst of that likability discussion, when Hillary said, kind of mockingly, "Oh, you've hurt my feelings," to the moderator. Then, of course, you have Barack Obama saying,
"You're likable enough."
Thank you so much.
Probably shouldn't have said it, didn't need to say it, didn't need to be part of that conversation, and it sounded a little patronizing and a little bit offensive, I think, to many women.
And what's happened since then? This is interesting, too, because, you know, this is a very fascinating thing. Once Obama won Iowa, then all the Republicans and all of the media who already anointed Hillary said, okay, wait a second, it's Obama that we have to, you know, concerned about. Obama will be the nominee. What would Obama versus McCain be like? Blah, blah, blah.
A lot of whiplash in the media.
Exactly.
Especially at Fox, where they had decided Hillary was going to be the nominee a year ago.
That's right. Karl Rove has talked about that for the longest time.
Absolutely. An article of faith. And wasn't she was already nominated.
And there was a Republican debate where I think they said Hillary Clinton's name 10 times more than they mentioned George W. Bush's name.
I think it was even more extreme than that. I think Bush was never mentioned, and she was mentioned 19 times in that particular debate. And rarely, if ever, do you hear any other Democratic candidate named in the Republican debates.
Now, look what's happened since then. As we speak, on this very day, as we're recording this podcast, just hours before the Republican-South Carolina debate.
I know, my watch is set.
You know, it's funny. I told my parents I wanted a watch for my birthday, so they let me. Yeah. But anyway, John Kerry, who did he endorse today with this new Hillary Clinton momentum?
Because this is the right time to share with you to make sure that we know that I have the confidence and that Barack Obama can be, will be, and should be the next president of the United States.
Talk about your KOD kiss of death. John Kerry came out today for Barack Obama.
But that's interesting. I mean,
I understand that Barack Obama refused to confirm.
Right.
La, 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 I didn't hear it. La, 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 la.
I wish people could see Ron just now. But there's something interesting about that. I mean, I have a feeling that this really is a battle for the Democratic nomination. And I suspect that perhaps if John Edwards does not win South Carolina on January 26th, that there's probably no place where he's going to win, and then he may decide to pull out and perhaps make an endorsement, and then it will be a one-on-one battle, and it could go on further than many people thought.
Yes, I think it will probably go at least into the smaller states of February 5th. We won't be able to determine it just on the five mega states that are voting on February 5th. And it's going to get down even, I think, past the 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 electoral vote states that are also voting on February 5th. And we're probably going to get down into some of the really small states before we can get a real decision between these candidates. And it's also possible that we could go beyond February 5th because neither of the two main candidates, Obama or Clinton, has really gotten that preponderance of delegate strength that would close it out. So we could be moving on into Virginia and Maryland and Wisconsin and eventually to
Howard Dean?
On Ohio and Texas on March 4th or even all the way to Pennsylvania on April 22nd. Yeah!
I know, the listeners are going to love that one.
And,
you know, also it's important to remember that every Democratic contest is proportional. It's not winner-take-all. So, therefore, just because one person could win, I mean, Hillary Clinton theoretically could win six states in a row, but if she wins it 52-48, 51-49, the delegate split is almost equal.
For example, out of New Hampshire, which played, of course, as a huge win for Hillary and, of course, was important and symbolic and turned around the media analysis, the delegate split was 9-8.
Yeah.
So if we have a series of those kinds of contests, we really could be going on for quite a long time.
Before we go on any further, I'd like to spend about 15 to 20 minutes talking about what Bill Richardson brought to this campaign. Never mind.
Fascinating as the results were on the Democratic side, perhaps the implication on the Republican side of the New Hampshire results is greater. Down the road, what do we do with no front runner in the Republican Party?
Well, I don't know what we do with it. I don't think the Republicans know what to do with it either, because this is a very unusual position they found themselves
in. Never seen it before.
Historically, Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, Bob Dole, the two Bushes, always they seem to coalesce behind a front runner early in the process. Now we have Huckabee winning Iowa. We have John McCain winning New Hampshire. We don't know who's going to win Michigan next Tuesday.
But if it is not Mitt Romney, does he narrow the field by getting
out? Well, you know something? I think not only only because he has so much money and he's spent so much money, you know, for, he's been preparing this race ever since he became pro-life, but it, which is true, mean, but true. But it's interesting the fact that, you know, for him to get up and say that, thank you, Wyoming.
There have been three races so far. I've gotten two silvers and one gold. Thank you. Thank you, Wyoming.
He did do very well in those Wyoming caucuses.
I know,
that were
I know.
So widely ignored over the weekend.
Well, NPR had a piece on it.
And that's why, yes, and that's thanks to you, Ken. You're an excellent editor.
Thank you.
He said, of course, in all his subsequent appearances, I've got two silvers and a gold. And the gold, of course, referring to Wyoming.
Oh, I thought that was his teeth.
I think that this is a salesman, a born salesman, putting a magnificent face on what has been essentially the tattering, the shredding of his national strategy. He had everything on Iowa and New Hampshire. He wanted to score a quick double victory so that he could play in the rest of the primaries with the guys that he thought were going to be the big boys, Fred Thompson, Rudy Giuliani. But instead, he's got himself in a death struggle with John McCain, whom he forgot about last summer, and Mike Huckabee.
We all forgot about John McCain.
That's true. And Mike Huckabee, who no one was paying any attention to until October.
I mean, look, he spent all that money, all that time in Iowa, and even if he was going to lose Iowa, he still had the fallback position, the safety net of New Hampshire. Both are gone. Now he's campaigning in Michigan with his business acumen.
The number one issue is who can help rebuild the economy in Michigan and the nation. Now, I'm kind of unusual. Among all the people running for president, I've actually worked in the economy.
I kind of think, seriously, that that's probably the way that Romney would have been most attractive as a candidate all along. Not this right-wing ideologue.
Social policy.
Social conservative.
I'll get to the right of anybody in this field on any issue. You name it, I'm to the right.
And criticizing the Huckabees and the McCains and the others in the field for being not true
conservatives.
And yet, of all people, other Republican bona fides.
Okay.
And can I say that on the air?
Bona fides?
Yeah.
Only if you say Republican first.
Okay. Well, I did. So for him to be questioning other people's credentials among conservatives, that was, I think, a stretch. I think that hurt him ultimately in the two states.
And now he's running in Michigan not only on business acumen, but on his last name. His father was a three-term governor, big auto exec.
Really?
George Romney. Yes, George Romney.
I
actually ran for president.
I don't remember. I must have been brainwashed.
In the 1968 cycle.
I must have been brainwashed.
I think that's a reference to the reason his campaign for president was quite so brief.
Back to Earth. Okay, sorry.
So he's now running in Michigan, largely just as the son of George Romney, who was a popular governor, was an auto executive, was a well-known, well-thought-of guy. And so basically he's back home in his home state, one of his several home states, saying, come on, people, I mean, I'm a Michigander, you've got to vote for me.
Here's a question. You and I are old-timers, so when we hear Michigan and Romney, to me that's a perfect match. It's like Sonny and Cassius. But I wonder about the people who live in Michigan.
It was 40 years ago.
Right, exactly.
It was 40 years ago. And I was just trying to get a statistic today for how many Michiganders today were alive and around and remember George Romney as their actual governor nearly 40 years ago. It can't be but a minor fraction.
Right.
And as a result, you're really trying to ask people to vote for you just because you were born in the state and you have a name that used to be familiar in the state decades ago.
I mean, that's why Soapy Williams is no longer running.
Well, that's exactly
right. Right. And
he was dead. Absolutely.
Right. So after Michigan
comes South Carolina and Nevada. But let's talk a little about South Carolina because it's so much more important to the Republicans. This is the state that has been the trigger ever since Lee Atwater invented their Republican primary back in the 1980s.
1980.
This has been the trigger which has set the voting pattern for the rest of the South, and the South has become the Republican homeland.
Unlike New Hampshire, unlike Iowa, every winner of the South Carolina Republican primary has gone on to win the nomination.
That is correct. And so we are probably going to see the Republican field winnowed next week, probably by the tune of one, by the Michigan primary, which could knock out Mitt Romney, and then possibly by the South Carolina primary, which could have the effect of severely weakening John McCain.
Do you think it might weaken Fred Thompson? Because he got a whopping 1% in New Hampshire, but could South Carolina hurt his candidacy? I ask you that, Ron Elving.
Can you build on 1%? I mean, what can you build on 1% that doesn't look a lot like 2%? Fred Thompson.
Yeah,
wow.
Wow is right.
Where can you go with that question?
Jerry Thompson.
This was the first time in my entire life of watching politics that I have seen a candidate in a nationally televised debate with his rivals actually miss the fact that he had been asked a question by the moderator. He actually had to say, what? As if to say, are you asking me that question? He was only sort of semi there.
somebody read great reviews. Somebody, you know, even before the play was written, the reviews were out, and they said, you know, this is the guy, and he's in the second coming of Reagan, and it doesn't matter that he's getting in the race 100 days before the Iowa caucuses, because he'll knock everybody over. Well,
this is his second coming as the second coming of Ronald Reagan, because when he first came to town in the mid-1990s, the Republicans actually let him, as a freshly elected senator, give the response to the president's State of the Union. He was really thought of as a coming star, and it's been like that ever since. He's been the coming star, but he never actually arrives.
And here's a chance where he had the best press reviews of any candidate. I mean, remember back in the summer or back in the spring of 2007, McCain was on the ropes. Nobody knew who Huckabee was. Romney was still trying to get his bearings. It was Fred Thompson who was going to save the Republican Party. And now I think it's not surprising to us, I suspect, if he's gone after South Carolina.
And here's an interesting little irony. Fred Thompson got in this presidential race in 2008 after having initially started the cycle as a fundraiser for another guy, John McCain, his former friend from the Senate. And he kept saying that he kept talking to people, and they kept saying, never John McCain, it'll never be John McCain. Fred, you're wasting your time. I'll never give that guy money. Why don't you run yourself? So he ran himself. And now what does he do? He stands up in a congratulates John McCain on winning the New Hampshire primary.
Now, yet, winning New Hampshire, as we saw in 2000, winning New Hampshire may not be everything that enough to put John McCain into the nominee's seat. Do we agree?
It's only been about kind of a 50-50 proposition. When somebody has won New Hampshire but not Iowa, it gets to be kind of a 50-50 whether they get the nomination.
As President Pat Buchanan would tell you.
He would certainly tell you that.
President Gary Hart.
He would tell you that immediately.
But again, South Carolina is a state that destroyed John McCain in 2000. It's a state where Mike Huckabee may see the good reception that he got in Iowa with evangelical voters. One quick thing about tonight's debate. I still suspect that Mike Huckabee and John McCain will still be on good speaking terms, even though we're almost writing off Mitt Romney in this whole thing. I still think Mitt Romney will be the focus, or at least the subject of barbs.
You think that Huckabee and McCain will be playing tag team against him, much like, for example, Edwards and Obama did against Hillary Clinton?
For a little bit while long, I still don't see the two of them going negative on each other. And, of course, that's David Broder's dream ticket, a McCain-Huckabee ticket.
And David Broder thinks this is going to be a wonderful, wonderful presidential year because we're going to have more uncertainty much longer into the process than we had ever thought, ever anticipated. There's even a scenario by which maybe three Republicans keep going past February 5th, or at least into February 5th, and they divvy the delegates so widely that we could get all the way to the convention without a sure winner.
Well, I don't have the same kind of drugs you have, but that would be the ultimate dream for us political junkies.
For we political junkies.
For us.
For us as political junkies. Right. That would be the ultimate political dream.
Ron?
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR News.
Exciting times, Ron.
Exciting times, Ken.